injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome to another podcast at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and other great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, S&R Remodeling, AMS, and the Axley Law Firm. Joining us now from the Capital Times and the Nation, it's John Nichols, who's also the author of a new book called The Horseman of the Trumpocalypse. John, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and congrats on pronouncing Trumpocalypse.
Your book tour is going well?
It's been great. We've been in, it seems all over, New York for lots of media, Washington, where we did, again, a lot of media, and also the great Politics and Prose bookstore, where C-SPAN taped an hour, which was...
When is that going to air? Generous.
It's been on, and it will repeatedly air.
Oh, good.
It was a lot. C-SPAN did a live hour.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I know, it's pretty cool. And then to Los Angeles, where we had some tremendous events, and I did Tavis Smiley's show, his TV show. And then up to San Francisco, where we did three bookstore events, which the kind of the nice part about it was that at all three, we had standing room only. It was also true in a number of the other places.
But have you been on with Alex Jones, or have you been on with Sean Hannity, or have you been on with Mark Levin?
You schedule your weeks in a way, you know, you kind of build toward the big stuff.
Okay.
And,
sure.
But I haven't quite made it there.
Sure. Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to those moments.
I would be delighted to join them. But I did, we did do Hardball and a number of other shows. And so I finish off in Seattle at Seattle Town Hall, which is a big venue, big thing. And then fly back to Madison, where we're going to do all sorts of cool stuff over the next couple of weeks.
All right, let's talk about state politics for a moment.
Yeah.
We had a major event in the Wisconsin State Assembly within the minority caucus, the very minority caucus of Democrats, 35 of them, were essentially, they ousted their leader, Peter Barca. You can call it a resignation. You can call it a stepping down. It's pretty clear that there was a coup.
Well, I mean, I think there was a recognition and of a conundrum that they've got. And that is that they've been in the minority now since 2010, since the 2010 election. Things haven't gotten better. They've actually, you know, basically gotten worse as regards their numbers. And so we're in a situation where the Democrats in the state assembly have not had a winning election cycle since 2008. It's almost a decade. And at a point like that, you really have to get beyond personalities. And you've got to start to focus in on, you know, I mean, obviously something's not going right. Yes, there's gerrymandering. Yes, there's money in politics. There's all the barriers and challenges that you face. But somehow, if you're gearing up for another election cycle and you've had so many bad ones, it's good to look for alternatives. And I think in the case, after Peter Barca voted for the Foxconn deal, which I understand his politics and his situation, he comes from an area where it's possible Foxconn will locate, but it's a terrible deal. It's an absolutely indefensible example of crony capitalism and kind of the worst of what government might engage in. So after he voted for that, I think many Democrats were relatively willing to forgive him because he came from the area. And then there was a sense that he had not merely voted for it, but also been worked pretty closely with the Republicans on it, and I think that just that was sort of a final straw for a lot of folks, and I think that's what you saw play out at the caucus meeting.
Do you get the feeling that there was a serious divide in the assembly over whether he should be ousted among younger members versus older members? Representative Sinicki from Milwaukee sort of indicated it was the younger members that were most angry with Peter Barca.
I think there's an element of that. And, you know, look, if you know Peter Barca, you know Peter quite well, and I do.
I do.
Also.
He's a good man.
He's very congenial.
Yeah.
He's a congenial, good man who has fought a lot of good fights over many, many decades. And I think there are certainly some older members of the Democratic caucus who believe that he was handed a horrible, you know, set of cards and told to play, and he did it with good spirit and some good energy, and they wanted to, you know, respect that. But I think there are also a lot of younger members who are looking at the prospect of, you know, something that seems like, you know, long-term disempowerment. And many younger members of the Democratic caucus have never been in the majority, and they've never served in a state assembly where you could suggest that they even had, you know, kind of an avenue of influence, because not only have they been in a minority circumstance, I think it's fair to say that the Assembly Democratic Caucus has sort of disappeared in the eyes of an awful lot of political observers in the state. So it's a doubly bad situation. Not only are they not in the majority, they're not, I think, seen as, you know, central to opposition to what's going on.
Is it
and
viewed,
I think a lot of these younger members wanted
is
more.
It viewed in contrast with Jen Schilling, the leader for the Democrats in the Senate? Is there a contrast there?
I think there is a contrast. I think that Jen Schilling, you know, who went through a really rough re-election, and I think a very jarring re-election, just narrowly held her seat in the 2016 election. I think that Jen Schilling...
That really didn't have anything to do with her. That was a collapse of rural vote for Democrats.
Right. Yeah, it's a Western tier and what happened out there. And again, you know, because with all due respect, the Democratic nominee for president in 2016 was the first Democratic nominee in, I think, my adult lifetime that didn't go to La Crosse during the fall campaign.
That's Bernie's fault. That's Bernie's fault. By the way, happy birthday. Happy birthday to Senator Sanders. He turned 76.
Yeah. And I think it would, it's so laughable to suggest that it's his fault. I mean, you know, there was incredibly bad strategy. I think, you know, stuff when they write the, you know, kind of 10 worst campaigns, certainly Hillary Clinton's fall campaign is going to rank high on that list.
She lost areas that Walter Mondale won.
Yes. In fact, the interesting thing is I did a big story for The Nation in the issue that's on the stands now about rural voting and rural America. And so I actually spent a lot of time with the data. And what's fascinating is I think there are some people who want to imagine that, you know, a lot of working class people shifted from the Democrats over to the Republicans. But boy, if you look at that data, what you realize is in an awful lot of these counties, what happened is the Democrats simply didn't come to the polls. The drop off in Democratic turnout, especially in some rural areas, is very, very striking. Now, for 2016, that's very bad news, and it certainly played a critical role in defining the results. For the future, I think there's actually an element of hope there, because if you can mobilize those people, they didn't switch over in a lot of those counties to the Republican side. What they did was they didn't come. That proved to be bad for Democrats at the top of the ticket and also down ballot.
And Representative Barca's demise as leader is sort of encapsulated in Representative Chris Danu's loss from Trempealeau.
I think so, although, yeah. You know, I mean, that's sort of the heart of the matter. But Danu's loss, an example of just how bad things got, but also the fact that nobody won. You know what I mean? That you weren't, you know, kind of on the march.
That they haven't been able to take a Democratic seat like the one that Todd Novak holds.
Right. And they came very close, by the way. I mean, it was highly competitive. But at a certain point, and again, this is to get a little bit beyond personalities and to suggest that I think over the years, Peter Barker tried hard. I think he was actually in many ways a happy warrior, a guy who, you know, was ready to get into fights, to march, to speak up, to take a lot of good stands. But it just didn't work. And at a certain point, you say, well, there's just a wisdom in trying something new. And also, again, I'll come back to, I don't think it was necessarily the only thing that was in play. In fact, I can guarantee it wasn't. And yet, the Foxconn deal is a big deal. The candidate for governor at this point, who seems to be getting the most traction among elected Democrats, Dana Wachs, very courageously, you know, and very early on, just came out against the deal and really spoke out against it in a lot of bold, strong ways. And then to have the leader of the Democratic caucus in the assembly vote for the deal and, you know, at least to some extent work with the Republicans to try and get it through. At the very least, it's a conflicting message. And I think that, again, a lot of these younger Democrats and folks who would like to, you know, really see the party get on a more activist footing, there is a sense that while it's perhaps a little bit risky, taking on the Foxconn deal and making it a big issue and really talking about how you should distribute the resources of state government and use, especially in areas of economic development and education and other things, that they like that fight. They're ready for that fight. You look at somebody like Gordon Hintz out of Oshkosh, you know, Hintz seized on that battle and became a very important source.
He was the first person I interviewed when the deal was put out there, and he was ready.
Yeah, and he was ready. He was ready to go.
Ready. Yeah. Right. All right, so let's talk about that. State Representative Gordon Hintz, who's been in the state assembly since 2006, is running to replace Barca. So far, no other names have emerged. Is this going to be a coronation, or do you think there's going to be a fight?
I think it's a good chance of a coronation. Not a certainty, but Hintz is kind of a unique figure. He's relatively young in the scheme of things. I'm sure he'd like us to say he's very young.
And an air guitarist champion.
And a pretty lively, fun character who, you know, if you go up to Oshkosh where he represents, he's really energized that party up there in a whole lot of ways. And so Hintz is, as I say, you know, kind of pretty upbeat, pretty lively younger member. At the same time, he's been in the assembly since the days when Democrats actually had a majority, right? So, you know, he's kind of seen how it could be, and some of the older members know him pretty well. He's a strong pro-union guy, and that's very, very important because where you have, especially, you know, the mix of members in the Assembly Caucus, you've got a lot of them from traditional union towns, Racine, Kenosha, Janesville, Oshkosh, you know what I mean, Green Bay. And so I think he's probably pretty well positioned to go forward. I could see somebody else, you know.
He's also, you know, on the Joint Finance Committee, but he has a unique combination of being very articulate and lively and colorful, but he's also a master of details and policy.
Well, what he did on Foxconn is, in my opinion, like almost a model of how to, you know, build opposition to a deal that at least initially was portrayed as, you know, certainly the governor went out of his way to try and portray Foxconn as just the greatest, you know, greatest thing since sliced bread. And the way to oppose that wasn't just simply to say no or to say you didn't like Walker. The way to oppose it was with a lot of facts, a lot of information, marshaled in really effective manners. He, you know, to give you an example, Hintz was putting up, you know, talking points, which interestingly enough became talking points for a lot of Democrats, but also became kind of framing points for the debate. Even the media, you know, say, oh yeah, that's an interesting point. What do you say about that, governor? And so I think it's, you know, he without saying that he's got everything right or some sort of perfect player, because, you know, he missteps along the way for sure, but He, in many ways, does the things that I think Democrats have been concerned weren't being done.
Well, you know, it's, so, it's interesting.
He runs as a strong candidate.
It's interesting that some Republicans immediately went on the attack, going after Representative Hinz's personal foibles. But Majority Leader Jim Steinke pushed back at them immediately, saying, "Hey, this is someone who's legitimately going to lead the other caucus, and we need to be able to work with the other side." Now Steinke has had his own problems, so maybe that makes him a little more understanding of the fact that humans hold these spots, not robots. But it was interesting that Steinke pushed back on that.
And I think it was a class act move, and I think Steinke does distinguish himself on a lot of levels from a lot of the other Republicans.
He really has over the last year, hasn't he?
Yeah.
On
all sorts of fights. He seems to be a guy who actually might be, I know it's a bizarre thing to suggest, interested in legislating.
Well, he has a swing district.
I know, but I don't think he's, to be honest, in looking at him and watching him, I don't think he lacks confidence. I think he's pretty sure he can win his swing district. But I think one of the reasons he's sure of that is because he's confident in himself and he has a style that he puts forward. And the other interesting thing about it, too, is I think he's not alone. I hear from more and more Republicans that there's a deep discomfort with the state Republican Party and with some people in the caucuses who, no matter who the Democrat is, it moves to immediate, kind of nuclear war, that you want to destroy this person every way imaginable. And you've seen it with the gubernatorial race. As Democrats have announced their candidacy, even Democrats who have a really uphill race, the state Republican Party has launched websites attacking them and,
people that you and I have never even heard of. All right, let's take a break. John Nichols with us from the Capital Times at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
You're listening to another podcast at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and many great local sponsors like St. Vincent de Paul. John, let's talk a little bit about the governor's race. We have covered so much of what's been going on with Trump in Washington that I kind of feel like things are starting to heat up in the state of Wisconsin. The other day, State Superintendent Tony Evers was on with Greg Newman on Channel 27, and Greg Newman asked the superintendent about Act 10. Here's the clip.
I want to ask you about Act 10. Andy Gronick was on this show and said, when it comes to Act 10, everything should be on the table in terms of taking another look at this law. What can be left in, what can be taken out? He even suggested he'd be open to looking at the amount that employees contribute to their pension and insurance. What part of Act 10 would be on the table for you?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, I was against Act 10, and I didn't take a pass on that. I didn't hear any of these other folks talking about it at the time. I was there at the Capitol with teachers from across the state. My goal as governor is this. I want to make sure that the people that are part of state agencies all across the state, and I'm be encouraging counties and school districts to do the same, to treat their employees with respect, to make sure that they have adequate access to grievances, making sure that we value their expertise, all those things that kind of were left on the side by Act 10. The reason I talk about it in those terms, Act 10 is, I don't anticipate that Act 10 is going to be a reversal on my desk when I get there.
Right.
And so we have to do something in the meantime. And just holding our breath and saying, well, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. What I can do is control what I can control. And that's the atmosphere and the culture that exists in state government.
That is not the answer that I believe Fighting Bob La Follette would have given.
No, of course not. that's not the answer that Fighting Pat Lucy would have given.
Fighting Pat Lucy.
Only a tiny portion of your listeners will get that one. But be that as it may, much of what Evers said there was good. I mean, this notion of the need to respect employees. And also, actually, I would even go to the point of the respecting the fact that there's not going to be an overturn measure on his desk the day he shows up. I accept all that. But, you know, as you work through this discussion, right, there comes a point where, you know, you have to, you're being asked about something. It's not hard. You have to say where you stand, you know, what you want to do. And to my mind, the proper place to go, the proper stance is to say, yeah, it's not going to be on my desk immediately. There's going to be some difficulty. There may even be some difficulty in organizing Democrats on this issue. But if you want to be a Democratic governor, what you should be in favor of is restoration of collective bargaining rights, the right to organize a union, the right to bargain in the workplace, and the protections that go with that. Also, the removal of the you know, kind of deal killer elements of Act 10, which are designed to destroy unions, to undermine them, to make it impossible for them to do their work, as well as the right to work law. We shouldn't just talk about Act 10. We should also talk about
project labor agreements, right to work.
All of it. And what a Democratic candidate for governor should say is that, like Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, and like Gaylord Nelson, John Reynolds, Pat Lucy, Marty Schreiber, Tony Earl, and Jim Doyle, and like Bill Proxmire, and Gaylord Nelson, and Herb Cole, and Russ Feingold, and Tammy Baldwin, if you're a Democratic governor, you believe in collective bargaining rights. Wisconsin is not a right-to-work state. Wisconsin is not a anti-public worker state in its modern arc of history. It is only that under Scott Walker, and when Scott Walker is replaced as governor, we should return to what is a mainstream, not even a liberal or progressive, a mainstream democratic value, which is that workers have a right to collective bargaining.
Isn't there an argument to be made that right now Act 10 is hurting public service in the state of Wisconsin? And I will give you the prime example, because it's so prominent, is the Veterans Home in King, Wisconsin, which is run by the state of Wisconsin and has been since the Civil War. They simply cannot hold on to employees because they can't earn enough and they can't air their grievances. And veterans are paying a price for Act 10. Isn't there an argument to be made?
No, but yes, you've cited it. One of the ones that touches our heart the most and makes us most concerned, because obviously Wisconsin's had a historic commitment, essentially since its founding, to caring for veterans and to doing right by them. And that is imperiled when you undermine the basic protections of the people who would go to those jobs. And you know, and among other things, by the way, here's an interesting dynamic, just for what it's worth. You got the state undermining protections for people who protect veterans and work with them. And then at the same time, we've got some of our Republican friends saying, well, it's a great thing there are whistleblowers in the federal VA, right? There's people that step up and point out where there are problems in the federal VA. That's a good thing. Well, one of the reasons they have stepped up is that they feel they're secure in their jobs, right? That there is union representation. And that's happened across this country. And so what I would suggest to you is there's a problem there. There's a problem in our public schools. There's a problem in all sorts of agencies. And that problem is twofold. Number one, a lot of good people leave. Number two, the people who stay are sent a very powerful signal that, you know, you're here for a job, you fill that role. But boy, if you want to advocate beyond that, if you want to say, no, there should be more money going for veteran services, there should be more money going for education, we should be protecting the people we serve, we should be, you know, able to speak up on their behalf, not just on our own behalf to say, oh, you know, glad I got this job or whatever, but also to say, we need to make circumstances here better.
All right.
That is easier with a union.
All right. The broader view of the governor's race and the way people are positioning themselves in this race. Tony Evers is running a very sort of conventional campaign. He is not coming out firing. He's being very low key. Dana Walks is taking a different tact, although there appears to be some regionalism that's being stirred up as well that I'm not sure is so smart.
It's what happens in politics,
right?
Whether you like it or not.
So tell me what you think about this governor's race in the primary so far.
Well, I think in my opinion, it's significant that you got statewide elected official in Evers, a relatively veteran legislator in Walks, and various other folks stepping up, considering running, already in the race. It's a good race. It's real. And it reminds me a little bit right now of the 1982 race where you had Tony Earle and some other folks.
Marty Schreiber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a third candidate.
Jim Wood.
Kind of pounding away on each other. And by the way, we also had an interesting race. I'll give you another example. In 2002, where you had a prominent statewide official, Jim Doyle, as well as a congressman in a county executive, right, running. So you had quality candidates, strength candidates with some strength. And what I'm suggesting is, this race is shaping up with a little of that. I think that's encouraging. When we go deeper into it, in my opinion, at least in the early stages, and I'm not saying this is somebody who's got some great sentiment for one of these over another, I just think that Walks has hit the ground running. He has come out and done some bold things. He's spoken well. He's been effective. And he's also shown courage. He's in a unique position because he had to take that vote on Foxconn. He didn't do it quietly. He didn't say, I'm voting.
No, he didn't him and ha. He didn't backfill.
He got out there early, and he actually made arguments. And the interesting thing is that the arguments he made were smart, strong, rooted in good understanding of Wisconsin business, where we are, where we might want to go. So, in my opinion, it's not surprising that in the last week or so, a striking number of elected officials have stepped up and endorsed Walks. I think he's got a little bit of traction there. Although it's early, and I'll give one thing to be generous to people, and that is to say, sometimes in your initial interviews, you don't always answer questions the way you should.
Tell me whether this is a good thing when a candidate, in this case Andy Gronick, has to answer this sort of question.
Now, as to that skill set, and you talking about being a business person, recent news articles, as you well know, say that you were fired by your father and sued by your former business partner for alleged fraudulent behavior. Now, how do you reconcile that with what you say is a skill set to be the governor of this state because of your business background?
Well, I transformed my father's business, and I will tell you that not only did he fire me when I offered to buy the business, really at the end of having grown it, he fired me pretty much every month. We had a very different view of that business. I came in, it was a small auction business serving mostly southeastern Wisconsin, and transformed it to an information business that was doing appraisals and business consulting on a national basis. The company became much larger than what my father was comfortable with. Then that caused us to hit heads, as I think a lot of father and son businesses do, for the entire 8 years that I was there. And we finally got to a point where, we have a different vision of where the business is going. I offered to buy the company, and he fired me. And this time I actually took him up on it.
Is that good?
Yeah, it is. It's not a great conversation to be in. I kind of felt a little sorry for the interviewer to have to bring that up. Yeah, did your dad fire you? By the same token, in fairness to Andy Gronick, look, when you're hit with a question like that, you lay the information out. You make your statement on where you think things were. To be honest, I think he sounded. I have to tell you, my background is very much in rural Wisconsin, and so my dad was a farm lawyer, and he represented a lot of farm families that owned, had owned a farm maybe for 140 years. What Gronick's talking about there is true. His father and son situations, they can and brother and brother, they can often get messy. And so I actually...
I think he's got a problem, and though he has two messy situations. He has a former...
He's got many of them.
Yeah.
And I also, to be honest with you, with all due respect, I'm not sure he's in the first tier of candidates.
I'm not sure either. Although, you know, he is an articulate person.
He's articulate.
Yeah.
He's hit some issues well.
Right.
And we at the Cap Times, we've written about him, you know, positively, that he's done some very good things. And I'm not going to take that away from him. I'm just saying that, you know, as somebody who does face some of the challenges he faces and is in a race with a very well-regarded legislator and a statewide elected official, his ability to get traction may not be quite as great as some of his
opponents. All right, we got to move through this one fast, but I thought this is kind of an interesting sign that I think Republican Congress people are a little nervous right now. Paul Ryan with terrible numbers, reelect numbers right now.
I know.
Congressman Glenn Grothman came to one of the more liberal parts of his district, and there aren't many liberal parts of his district, but, you know, Columbia County is not a right-wing Republican county.
No, it's and a swing area.
And is in the Madison media market, which also makes it kind of an oddity for that district. So here is Congressman Grothman, who went to Portage the other day talking about a couple things. Let me just play both these clips, and then I'll get a response from you.
Because of the Democratic bill, I just think all of a sudden, after spending way too much money everywhere under the sun, they are afraid to cut back on the money the federal government earns on the interest on federal loan debt, which is just ridiculous. All of a sudden, you're dealing with 30-year-old people who may be 35 or 40 grand in debt. They can't buy a house. They can't have kids. And there you're saying that's how we're going to balance the budget of all people to balance the budget. That's ridiculous.
You took a lot of tough questions here, and you said that a lot of people are upset that other representatives of theirs won't have these kinds of meetings and take tough questions. You said they have a right to be upset.
Well, I think congressmen should do this sort of thing. I mean, I get out and meet people in a lot of other forums. And you obviously don't get a cross-section in this sort of thing, but probably for the last 80 years anyway, congressmen have been doing town hall meetings. And you do meet a certain segment of the population right now because they're mad at Trump, disproportionately more of a Democrat part of the population, but I represent a lot of Democrats too. And I like to give them an opportunity to tell me their view on things because a lot of times I agree with their view on things.
Whoa, that's something, isn't it?
It's not necessarily how everybody sees Glenn Grothman, but it's how he sees himself. And I would say that was an outstanding answer, don't you think?
Both answers.
I mean, yeah, completely. I mean, did they give him the reasonable pills or something? Interesting thing is that Grothman faces a potentially serious challenge from an opponent who actually has resources. One thing about Glenn Grothman, who I think is, you know, often on the fringe of the fringe as regards right-wing ideology, he is a political careerist. He has, you know, basically this is what he's done for a very long time. And he has beaten incumbents. He has, you know, won tough primaries. And I think you saw some of his political skills there.
It is kind of a statement of the times we're living in this year. I'm not sure he would have talked like that when he was running for Congress in the primary.
I'm not sure he would have talked like that in the old days when Charlie Sykes was a conservative and, you know, you had talk radio that kind of... Remember a couple years ago, not that long ago, when conservative talk radio sort of policed conservatives and you had to be the... You had to be the wackiest in order to be credible. Those are the folks who made Glenn Grothman.
Yes,
when I see
Charlie Sykes talking about the craziness of the Republican Party, I remind people that Charlie Sykes endorsed Glenn Grothman against a far more moderate candidate that was much closer to the mainstream.
and to where, no, I mean, this is an important thing to understand. It's not just Charlie, it's the whole of conservative talk radio, and which something now Charlie writes about and talks about, I think, in pretty thoughtful ways. But we should remember, there's no way Glenn Grothman would be in Congress today if it wasn't that right when talk radio in the cycle he was coming up looked around and said, okay, who's the furthest out character of the bunch? And they went with Glenn Grossman. And he continues to be a very far from the mainstream elected official and someone who's very out of sync with the Republicans who represented that district. You know, when you think of Bill Steiger and Tom Petri, who represented that district for the better part of 50 years, they did so as Republicans who, A, worked very, very well with people across the aisle, and B, were deeply concerned about making their party a mainstream party on issues of civil rights and all of other concerns.
Indeed. Yeah. And by the way, I should just make note as we wrap up today that I don't think there's anyone who's ever had more egg on their face than Rush Limbaugh after what he did this week.
A little bit of exit. I understand he's decided to evacuate.
Yes, he did. After saying but that
he's running from the fake news.
The hurricane, he put out the hurricane predictions he put out as a global warming hoax propagated by the mainstream media.
So one of these days, when we get a little more time, we'll talk about how Scott Pruitt's reaction to all these hurricanes has been to repeat up and say, as head of the EPA, you know, yeah, I know there's a lot of concerns with toxics and chemicals and all this stuff like that, but I really want to remind you, we shouldn't be talking about climate change.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming on with us, brother.
Pleasure, man.
Slysoffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.